here, but gotta get to work.
We are?
I thought we were gonna have Steve, but yeah, okay, maybe not. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the January 28th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Novick. Hales.
Here. Welcome. We have a single item on the calendar this afternoon, which is a report. Would you please read that item?
Item 97, transmit report to the City of Portland on Portland Police Bureau officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths by the Office of Independent Review.
Auditor Caballero, are you going to lead off? And Constantine, good afternoon. Come on up. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, I'm City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero. I think we all agree that clarity is a welcome addition to any discussion of Portland's police accountability system. And today we have some, by way of the latest comprehensive assessment by outside experts of officer-involved shootings. Our predecessors had the foresight to require through city code independent reviews of police bureau officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths. The auditor's independent police review does not investigate officer-involved shootings or in-custody deaths. The Citizens Review Committee does not hear appeals of such cases. Instead, Portland's oversight model relies on law enforcement experts with a national perspective, such as those who are here today, to assess these types of critical incidents. The first outside assessment occurred in 2003. Back then, there was a virtual absence of internal administrative reviews of these types of cases. Much progress has been made since then, but as you will learn today, much important work is left to do. And now I'd like to turn it over to Director Constantine Sevier of the Auditor's Independent Police Review, who has a few remarks, and then he'll introduce the principals from the OIR group.
Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, it's my pleasure today to introduce Julie Rulin and Michael Janaka from the Office of Independent Review, OIR. Ms. Rulin is an attorney who, in private practice, specializes in criminal defense and civil rights in California. Ms. Rulin formerly worked with the Police Assessment Resource Center, PARC, which was the entity that did the first set of outside expert reviews as mandated by counsel. Mike Janaka is a former assistant United States attorney who serves as the chief of the Civil Rights Section for the Central District of California. As director of the Independent Police Review, one of my most important duties is to fulfill the council mandate that there is a review of all closed officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths. Our OIR's fourth report on officer-involved shootings and custody deaths builds upon their earlier reports. This is the ninth outside report, including the previous PARC reports and OIR's standalone report on the investigation into the death of James Chassie, which was completed in 2010. As a result of these outside reviews, there is now a criminal investigation completed by Portland Police Bureau's Detectives Division to determine the criminal conduct of involved member, as well as a separate administrative investigation conducted by Internal Affairs to determine whether there is any violation of policy, which was not always the case prior to outside review. The quality and depth of administrative investigations have improved dramatically in the last 15 years. All officer-involved shootings and custody deaths go to a police review board composed of PPB members, community members, and an IPR representative, which makes a recommendation to the chief of police as well as the police commissioner. There is also a public report on every case heard by the police review board. I believe when the city has taken full advantage of these reports, it has given an early access to emerging best practices in the field of police oversight. But when we as a city have failed to implement common sense recommendations from these national experts, there has been a price to pay in diminished public trust and confidence in our system. Two notable examples of this has been, in particular, the 48-hour rule, which requires advance notice to an involved officer prior to a compelled administrative interview. An additional area of concern that OIR has noted in several of its prior reports is how long the internal review process has taken. An additional benefit of these reports has been that they have been a resource to our community. OIR's decision to include officer names as well as subject names have made the reports easier to read and much more transparent. The Police Bureau is to be commended to following and carrying through on over 100 recommendations made over the course of these reports. But the community itself has provided additional recommendations and built upon the work done by both by PARC and OIR. Few examples would be work done by the Citizen Review Committee and the Stakeholders Committee that was convened in 2010 to look at the oversight structure of the City of Portland. As a result of the OIR's report in the Chassis case, IPR was authorized by council to act as a monitor in all officer-involved shootings and custody deaths. Since June 2011, IPR has responded to the scene of every officer-involved shooting in custody death, and the Police Bureau, to its credit, has facilitated that and has worked as partners in making sure that IPR has access to scenes and has access to evidence as needed. And with that, I would like to call OIR to the front. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both. Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, Commissioners, my name is Michael Giannacco, and it's good to see you all again. We had the opportunity to visit with you, I believe, when we issued our third report, and some of you even before that. So this is, as Constantine has indicated, the fourth report with regard to officer-involved shooting review. We also did an initial report surrounding the death of Mr. Chassis. The report contains 11 officer-involved shootings over approximately a year and a half period of time, and it dissects each shooting and looks at issues coming out of the shooting, not for purposes of relitigating whether or not there should have been criminal charges or accountability, but more to evaluate how the Portland Police Bureau itself did with regard to the investigation, with regard to the review, and whether or not the Portland Bureau Police Bureau took sufficient notice of the shootings and issues coming out of the shootings, sort of as a lessons learned. One of our philosophies, consistent with, I think, better practices throughout the country, is that critical incidents like officer-involved shootings or in-custody deaths present, unfortunately, a tragic situation in which a person is often injured and sometimes killed. And it is the exercise of the utmost power that we give our police officers, which is the ability and authority to use deadly force. So because of the impact that such an event has on individual members of the Portland community, as well as the Portland community at large and the Bureau, we believe that it is incumbent upon the Bureau to collect sufficient facts and evaluate the case so that its members are better, one, for accountability, but also to ensure that its members are better prepared on a forward-going basis to deal with tomorrow's challenges. Because as we have seen, those challenges often repeat themselves, and if insufficient guidance, training, supervision is not provided to police officers based on lessons learned from the past, it is doomed to repeat those unfortunate events in the future. What can we say about how the Bureau did? I think we also agree that if you look over the five-year arc in which we have reviewed the shootings coming out of the Bureau, we have seen significant improvement in all areas that we would issue a report card on. That is, we've seen significant improvement with the way in which investigations are conducted, and also continued improvement arc in the way in which investigations are reviewed. In addition, with regard to the way in which the Bureau has responded to these incidents, it's clear that in some of the cases, at least, the guidance, the training, the lessons learned from past experience has become inculcated in the Bureau so that the Bureau had better tools, better responses, on some of the more recent cases that we've looked at. Is all perfect? No. Did we expect it all to be perfect? Absolutely not, because every time you are presented with a new set of situations, you're going to have different circumstances. And while training is important, there's always going, because these kinds of tactical decision makings are perishable skills, it's important to continue to keep your attention to these issues on a continual basis. We have issued in the report a couple of either items. The last of the appendix sets out a chart of all of the 35 critical incidents that we have reviewed during our tenure and indicates some salient features with regard to each of those shootings. We thought, since this is the end of our contractual period, it would be important to set out in sort of a historical chart-like way some of the all of the events and some of the salient features to them as a reference piece for any members of the community and the Bureau itself who might be interested. We've also issued in this report 31 recommendations, and while it is not our intent to go over all 31 recommendations this afternoon, we hope to highlight some of the recommendations that we think are most important to this body and to your public. We are also, of course, prepared to answer any questions that might be in your all's thoughts upon reviewing our report, and stand ready as a resource to do that. We are also, obviously, if public comment suggests or spurs other questions in your mind that you would like us to address, we are here to do that. You should also know that we spent all day yesterday as well interacting with your community. We had community meetings. We met with the Bureau with regard to not only the report but other issues on a sort of going forward, where are we now basis. And we continue to do that, and we find that those meetings are indispensable to our work. One, for purposes of transparency, but also because the dialogue we receive from your very well-informed community informs us with regard to the issues that are present in Portland. We are not Portlanders, and for that reason, we think it's imperative for us to continue to do that. So at this point, if you will, what I'd like to do is to turn it over to my colleague, Julie Rulin, who will talk to you probably about the predominant theme that comes out of these officer-involved shootings and the recommendation we make in response to it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Julie.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Julie Rulin with the OIR Group. The one very striking thing about these 11 shootings that we review in this report is that in 7 of them, there's some evidence that the subject had an intent to provoke the police officers into shooting him and some desire to end his own life. This dynamic is very commonly referred to as suicide by cop, and that is a term we find problematic. It ignores the reality that the responding officers to these situations have some ability to influence the outcome of these very often very complex scenarios by employing good tactics that adhere to principles of officer safety. It instead leads people to conclude that the outcome of these shootings is somehow inevitable, that the death or the shooting was inevitable, that there was nothing that the police officers could have done to prevent a use of deadly force. And I think this in turn creates, and we have seen repeatedly in the work that we've done, that it creates a tendency to be less rigorous in your analysis of the event. And we saw that in a couple of cases that we review here. In the shooting death of Brad Morgan, the training division review in that case really tackled this issue and acknowledged that there were things that officers maybe could have done differently that might have led to a different outcome. And then training used that acknowledgement to really drive forward some changes to the way that they train officers and some innovative ideas for how you do train officers to deal with crisis communication in these kinds of situations. but the commander's review in that case, and the commander's review is the there's a findings memo that goes to the police review board. And in that case, the commander fell into this inevitability trap and wrote that there was nothing he felt officers could have done to prevent Mr. Morgan from forcing officers to take his life that night. And again, in the shooting death of Mr. Higginbotham, we found similar kinds of language in both the training review and the commander's review, and again, falling into this inevitability trap and this notion that that Mr. Higginbotham's actions really drove the outcome. And without really acknowledging how the officers' lack of information gathering and tactical planning may have influenced the outcome in that case. At the same time, we saw other cases in this group of seven where officers did employ sound tactics and did follow principles of officer safety and nonetheless ended up shooting at or shooting the subject. So we don't mean to suggest that the Bureau's officers will always be able to control an outcome. I think that's an important caveat here. What we do want to emphasize is that the analysis that Mike talked about in his opening remarks is important in every case. It's very important to look not just at the moment that the officer pulled the trigger and the decision to shoot or not shoot, but to really unwind these events and look at all of the decisions leading up to it, up to that moment of the shooting. So it's important always, but in particular, where it's evident that the subject wanted to precipitate a response from officers in this encounter with a desire to end his life, I think it's really particularly important that the Bureau guard against compromising the rigor of its analysis and falling into this notion that there was nothing that could have been done to prevent the outcome, and really to change the language and the mentality around these scenarios to get rid of that notion that the outcome, that the shooting, the death, was inevitable. And that's the recommendation that goes along with our discussion here.
Mr. Mayor and commissioners, I would just highlight two additional, or actually three additional points. One are sort of related, having to do with the investigation itself. And as Mr. Sevier, as Constantine indicated, there has been some concern over our review period of 5+ years about the timeliness of the investigations. It just seems to take too darn long to get the investigation and review process completed. And that creates a whole lot of issues. One, it leaves the officer and the community with a sort of Damocles sword waiting for a final result and resolution of these cases for too long. And as you are likely aware, the Department of Justice in its settlement agreement pointed to the delay or the length of time in investigations as one of the issues that it is asking or requesting or actually, I guess, demanding that the Bureau address. And my understanding, and we can report that there is some optimism here, because when we looked at the last couple shootings in line here, we saw a much shorter investigative and review arc. So it looks like that the Bureau, working with IPR, is getting a handle on this issue, and we expect that other shootings that occur will also have a more compressed time schedule that will be in line with investigative standards and the expectations of the U.S. Department of Justice. There continues to be one investigative issue that we're going to continue to hammer home as long as we're doing this work, and that is the unfortunate situation that prohibits the Bureau from obtaining a statement from its members the night of the incident. As a result of an agreement reached between its association, its officers' association, the Bureau is not allowed to receive any information or any account from its officers about what they did that night, why they decided to use deadly force, until at least 2 days after the event. And we find that that condition in and of itself makes it difficult for us to say that the investigation is entirely comporting with best investigative standards. We understand that the agreement is up for renewal next year, and we are hopeful that this issue be revisited in the negotiations leading up to the new agreement with your association.
Let me just clarify that.
Yes.
A while. I thought the rule was that you couldn't be interviewed, but they don't even provide any documentation of what happened?
There is no documentation. Officer-involved shootings, there is no requirement to provide a police report at all. Instead, it's an interview. And while the officers are asked to provide voluntary interviews the night of the incident, most recently, over the past several years, they have declined that opportunity. And there's no ability to compel officers to provide information until at least 48 hours after the incident.
Thanks for the clarification.
Sure. The final issue that I'm going to address has to do with an issue that continues to be raised throughout the country, and that is the unfortunate situation in which officers are confronted with an individual who is armed with a knife. That has happened recently in the city of Chicago. It's happened in the city of San Francisco. And in both cases, it has created significant controversy in which an individual has ended up being shot and killed as a result of wielding a knife. That happened as well in one of the cases that was up for review this time, the Higginbotham case, where a man came out of an abandoned car wash with a knife. And when one of the involved officers in the Higginbotham case testified before the grand jury, he indicated that he had been trained about the 21-foot rule. The 21-foot rule was created in 1988 by an individual in the Midwest who decided that he would do some informal scientific study and made a determination that if you get close to an individual who's carrying a knife within 21 feet, that you are therefore too close and are in the kill zone and therefore must be wary of that individual and may need to use deadly force in response. While, in fact, the science is kind of important to know, and in fact it is true that action-reaction times do present challenges to officers, particularly with someone who is armed with an edged weapon. What we are concerned about is that the message or takeaway from that lore would be that if I am 21 feet or less away from an individual carrying a knife, my only option may be deadly force, when in fact that's not the case. And I don't even think that was the original intent of the training. But what we're worried about is that might be how it's interpreted by officers. So what we've asked is our recommendation is that the Bureau make sure that its officers have an understanding of the relationship in between distance and reaction action time. But really our thinking and our recommendation is the message should be that's why you don't get too close to an individual who is carrying an edged weapon or a knife. That's why you seek cover, tactically reposition, and not present a situation where you are allowed the suspect to get that close to you and then feel threatened by his coming at you with a knife. We have two final issues that I'd like Julie just to address, and then obviously we're open for any additional questions you all may have.
Yeah, so there are two issues that we have addressed repeatedly in our reports over the years, and I just want to touch on them here. One of them is the role of sergeants on the scene of a critical incident. Ideally, when you have a sergeant on scene, and ideally you do have a sergeant on scene, and I think it's good. Unlike some of the agencies we've worked with, Portland often has sergeants. They're out in the field. They're not stuck in an office doing paperwork. They're out in the field. They're supervising. When they're on the scene of a critical incident, as it's unfolding, ideally the sergeant's role is to be a supervisor, to assert command over the scene, command over the situation, to direct resources, to ask for appropriate resources, and to delegate assignments to the officers who are there. training. This is consistent with what training teaches. It's how they teach sergeants in their Sergeant's Academy and in in-service training for sergeants. But unfortunately, we don't always see it play out that way as these incidents unfold. In four of the cases that we reviewed, sergeants assigned themselves to take on a tactical responsibility instead of delegating that responsibility to officers. And in two of those, sergeants ended up using deadly force. In only one of those cases was this issue really flagged by the Bureau, and that was in the case involving Brad Morgan. The training division review identified this issue and acknowledged that it was not ideal for the sergeant to have put himself into the position where he was one of those communicating with Mr. Morgan. The commander's memo, again, sort of minimized this issue. And likewise, in the other three cases that we saw, that we reviewed here, where this was an issue, both the training review and the commander's memos just didn't really address this issue. And so, you know, you've got this training in place, but the second piece of that is accountability. And we found that in these four cases, that accountability piece wasn't followed through on, and that really minimizes the effectiveness of the training. It's impossible to say in any of those scenarios how a sergeant on scene asserting a strong supervisory presence, how or whether that would have made a difference in the outcome. But the fact is, that is the ideal, and we just think that the Bureau needs to be paying greater attention to that in its review of cases and its accountability decisions. The second and final issue that we want to talk about that, again, we have addressed throughout our work here is the speed with which subjects who are injured in an officer-involved shooting, the speed with which medical treatment arrives or that officers provide medical treatment to those people. And so, you know, the issue is somebody is shot, they're down, and there is still the possibility, either we know, the officers know, or believe them to still be armed, and so they still present a risk, a danger, and so it may not be safe for officers to just walk right up on them. It's not safe for paramedics to come into the scene until the weapon has been secured, and the subject has been secured. This is an area where, you know, we are optimistic, and we can say that the Bureau is moving definitely in the right direction. And in 2010, following the death of Aaron Campbell, this was a major issue. The length of time that it took for medical care providers to get to Mr. Campbell and identify that he had been deceased, was just too long. And in its response to that, the Bureau equipped all of its sergeants' cars with ballistic shields. So the idea is that officers can have these shields, they can approach, they form a team and approach and secure the weapon, secure the subject, and the shield provides some measure of safety should the subject pick up the gun and start shooting. And so we saw in a number of the cases that we reviewed, of these 11 cases for this report, where officers and sergeants very quickly, they knew the shield was there, they got the shield together, they got a team, they approached, and they very quickly did get medical care to the injured subjects. And so I think that's a big positive. There were still two cases where there were some questions about the sergeant's training, and they weren't really comfortable with how to use the shields and the limitations of the shields. And so that's an issue that I think the Bureau knows it needs to address to make sure that all of its sergeants understand why those shields are in their car and what they're to be used for.
Would you, since you've mentioned Mr. Higginbotham and Mr. Morgan, and one involved a gun and one involved a knife, could you explain just generally what's the difference in the weapon and how it impacts the protocol? For example, if someone has a knife and they've been shot and you've at least initially determined that it appears they only have a knife, how might you treat that instance differently than if the person, as with Mr. Morgan, he flashed a gun?
You mean after the shooting and they're down? And
yeah.
Yeah, I think the gun, obviously, I think, produce it. creates a greater sense of risk because the gun can harm you from a greater distance. And so if a knife is there, I still think, you know, if there's somebody's got a knife in their hand and they're down, what you often see in law enforcement training is a concern that they may be waiting for you to approach so that you can they could use the knife or the gun. But, of course, the distance is a different threat. And so if the knife has fallen out of their hand and you can see that, I think officers can, with much greater degree of confidence, feel like they can safely approach.
Because it appears in both instances the officers were treated, waiting for some event in order to more safely go and inspect the person who had been shot. But if an officer determines, if they're reasonably sure that the only thing you've identified is a knife and someone is down, it's just by it seems like common sense says there's a different risk factor.
Yes, agreed.
So in one of the cases, Mr. Hatch, one of the tragedies, Mr. Hatch, the responding staff decided to use a canine to bite the person. How often does that happen?
Honestly, I've not seen that before.
That's not common.
That's not a practice that we've seen commonly used by other agencies, and it's why we raised it and made a recommendation about that, that the Bureau really evaluate whether that's appropriate, especially in a scenario like that one where they had a ballistic shield available.
Was there any evidence in the record as to why this shield was not used?
They did use the shield.
Oh.
And, in fact, the sergeants in that case were prepared to move forward with just the shield, and the canine officer was there. I think it was a canine sergeant who suggested that they use the canine as an added measure, and they did. There's not a lot of analysis of that decision in the record, so it's not clear exactly, why they... If they felt the shield was not sufficient, so it's definitely an area I think the Bureau needs to do some introspection on and possibly change the way it trains on the use of a canine following a shooting.
Was that the only case of the use of a canine in the ones that you reviewed?
In this group, yes. In the Aaron Campbell case, there was a canine, though it was not used for quite the same purpose. There, the canine was released kind of simultaneous with the shooting.
Right, and I then remember the, that.
He okay. still sort of got there and did
it
his bite before,
purpose.
But it wasn't for this purpose.
Thank you.
The final piece, we're always trying to come up with common themes. And one common theme that I'm going to say now for the fifth time, because this is the fifth time we've had the privilege before to appear before this body and your community, is has to do with the cooperation we get from IPR, from the Bureau, with regard to our abilities to do our work. Access issues are never issues in this city with regard to our relationship with the Bureau and never have been. And we get everything we ask for, and more importantly, we are able to go behind the documents by having access to the people who created them, by the people who know about training, and we have had a free ability to go where we want in order to come up with the recommendations that we've had. And for that, we're grateful. The other thing that has happened repeatedly is in our after-report meetings with the Bureau, and as we are coming to the completion of each report, we have what we think is a constructive dialogue. One of the things, I do this with a number of agencies, and one of the things that always makes me nervous is when the chief of police responds by saying, it's a great report, we've already going to implement all of them immediately. That means that most likely that report is going to go on the shelf. So instead we get a really deeper dive than that, and we actually get some reflection. And some of the times, some of the responses from the Bureau causes us to reflect upon what we have recommended. So that is very helpful, I think, to the process here. And one of the things we find commendable of your Bureau.
Okay, other questions, issues to probe at this point in the process? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Want to give Chief O'Day and his staff a chance to respond, and then we'll take testimony if anyone wants to speak about the report. I'll lose you there, George.
I know, it's spinning on me. I can't hit a moving target.
Thank you, Mayor. For the record, I'm Larry O'Day, Chief of Police. I'm joined by Commander George Burke of our Detective Division and Captain Brian Parman of our Training Division. I want to thank the Mayor, Commissioners, and the Auditor for the opportunity for us to respond to the fourth report by the OIR Group regarding officer-involved shootings during the period of January 2011 to March 2013. As you all are aware, the Portland Police Bureau has made significant changes to its policies, procedures, accountability, and training over the last several years. Since the shootings referenced in this report, the Police Bureau has also made changes in the training we provide to Bureau members, particularly in regard to the use of force and our response to people in behavioral health crisis. This is ongoing as we continue to make additional enhancements as we work with the Department of Justice on action items in the settlement agreement, as well as developing and implementing 21st century best policing practices. However, there's always room for improvement when discussing our tactical responses, our deadly force investigations, and our review processes. The Police Bureau is committed to continually evaluating, learning, and making changes that improve our organization. I'm pleased to report that the Police Bureau agrees with almost every recommendation in this report, and several of them are our current practice. I've completed a response to each of these recommendations, forwarded that to the auditor today, and I'm sure she'll put it on her website. We'll put it out on our website as well. We greatly appreciate the recognition the OIR group provided to the Portland Police Bureau in regard to the Bureau's continued openness to critique, to the significant strides we've made since the very first report, and to our high level of cooperation we have demonstrated during these four reports. I also want to thank the OIR group for their professionalism and their responsiveness. They have consistently made themselves available by phone and in person and are always open to robust discussions that lead to sound recommendations and improvement within the Police Bureau. The use of deadly force is the most critical decision an officer will ever make, and we need to understand the need for our community to understand and discover what occurred during these incidents. The events over the last year, from Ferguson to Baltimore to Chicago and cities across the country, has deepened the valley between law enforcement and the communities we serve. Building trust within our community remains a top priority, and we continue to engage our community in new and thoughtful ways. In closing, I want to recognize our police officers as well as our investigators and detectives whose work appears in these reports. Every week, our officers risk their safety, they save lives, and they protect and serve our community. Every week, our detectives and investigators work hard to seek the truth and build solid investigations. All of our Bureau members have responded incredibly to the tremendous amount of institutional change that we are undergoing. They have dedicated their lives to community service, and I'm privileged to work alongside them. Thank you.
Thank you. Captain, Commander, anything else? Questions for the Chief and his team?
Chief, there's been a little bit of, obviously, in your response to the recommendations and the testimony and the presentation we had, there's a lot of focus on the 48-hour rule. So a couple questions on that. In your extensive response, you note that you have negotiated a change with the PPCOA. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yes, sir. Their contract was up for renegotiation, and so we put that in as one of our priorities to work through. At the close of that collective bargaining process, we were able to successfully remove that advance notification or so-called 48-hour rule language during that process.
So you successfully removed it with the police, Portland Police Commanding Officers Association contract.
Yes, sir.
So, and because this is a complicated area, and I think your memo makes that abundantly clear, could you just briefly explain to us the difference between a criminal investigation and an administrative investigation and the different rights that attach to both?
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to address that. You'll notice in my response, Most of my responses are a couple of paragraphs, and that one is about more than 2 pages. It really is a complex topic. There is a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about what that removal would do and what it wouldn't do. And with that, I have my investigations expert, Commander George Burke, here, and I'll have him start that explanation.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Council members. Thanks for the opportunity. I really, in looking at this issue, it's really clear that we separate these two different tracks that the investigation takes. The criminal investigation really looks at the Oregon Revised Statutes and how the actions of the officers fit within the criminal aspect of law. The administrative side really focuses on policy procedures. It gets into the training analysis and follows that track. The important difference is that in a criminal investigation, those members who are involved have every right under the U.S. Constitution that any other member would have in the country. So we cannot and do not compel them to make a statement immediately. I would like to highlight, and I appreciate the fact that Mike Giannaco pointed out the fact that it's not a prohibition for us to ask for them to give us a statement, but rather it's an ask that detectives always ask at the time of the event to get a voluntary statement and a walkthrough from the involved member.
So just to put a finer point on that, on the administrative side, you have more, according to your memo, you have more latitude, and you have the incentive, if you will, for an officer to comply with an administrative investigation is that you can sanction that person. You can use discipline if they refuse to. In a criminal investigation, officers have the same Fifth Amendment rights as citizens. I'm trying to follow your what you said. And therefore, you can request, but you can't compel. So give us an example of what happens, in your view, if either, you know, within the first hour or after 48 hours, you compel someone to give a statement in the context of a criminal investigation. What's the consequence?
Okay, so another thing to keep in mind here is the criminal investigation, any death, so if there's a death as a result of the use of deadly force, which, I mean, that's not always the outcome, but in cases where it is, that investigation is really run by the district attorney. And under Oregon Revised Statutes, they have the authority to run all death investigations. We run the risk in conferring with the DA's office along with the city attorney's office that if an officer were compelled to give a statement, that the concept of transactional immunity would carry that order to give a statement into any voluntary statement that we might get afterwards. So the thought that once we compel that we can then get a voluntary statement, there's a risk that creates some level of immunity for the officer who used that level of force. So that's where the real complication comes in as far as dealing with a compelled statement and a voluntary statement.
Okay, so just so that we're clear about calibrating community expectations, let's take the PPCOA contract where you've successfully removed the 48-hour notice requirement. That means that in the context of a criminal investigation, you can request that someone give a statement, but you still have the constitutional question, so you cannot compel. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So there is the possibility of an earlier and more contemporaneous voluntary statement, but you still don't have a tool to compel someone to give that statement in the context of the criminal investigation?
That's correct. And the other part of that is really that again, going back to the direction of the district attorney, the criminal investigation, we don't want to do anything that's going to cause us a problem with the criminal investigation, any admissibility as a result of any compelled statement that might come out of that. This is a really complex, and I think as you look at the response, the complexities really show through with working cooperatively with the district attorney for Multnomah County and getting agreement with the district attorney to allow us to go down that road because, again, they control that piece of
the
investigation.
And the thing that I feel like this is like Groundhog Day because we've had this discussion repeatedly at council. And frankly, I'm one of two lawyers on the council, and I come away even more confused about the legal landscape. And if I'm confused, then I'm guessing the public is going to be confused. And the key here is whatever we do and whatever we change, we must be very clear with the public about what they can expect differently. Because if we say that, you know, if there's a lot of if we make a big deal about some change like this, and then in practice it doesn't lead to changes in the way investigations occur, then of course we have a credibility problem. And you know, I'm reminded, this is not a perfect example, but I'm reminded that when Oliver North was hauled before Congress and his lawyers said, don't do this, and Congress said, no, we have the right to do it, and they compelled him to answer questions before the United States Congress, and his lawyers said, well, there's something called the Fifth Amendment. You can't make him incriminate himself. He said, no, we are directing you under threat of contempt. So Oliver North answered all the questions that were thrown his way. Ultimately, his conviction was overturned because the appellate court said you can't compel someone to give up their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. So it was good theater, but it didn't actually move the ball. And by the way, his lead lawyers in the case were the ACLU, not because they had any particular fondness, I suppose, for anything he had done in his official capacity, but they thought the Fifth Amendment applied to everybody. So this is the part that just sooner rather than later, I hope we have more clarity about, because your memo has all the nuances. The public discussion is usually not as nuanced. It's let's remove the 48-hour rule, and there's a inherent benefit to the process. Yes and no. Not if you can't compel someone to testify, and that is the question, whether or not you can compel someone to testify. And I'm hoping before we leave today I have a better understanding of that question.
And Commissioner Fish, to address what you're saying there, part of the issue has to do with what we can do with that information. Even if we were to go down the road of getting a compelled statement at the time of the event, a lot of that has to do with what information we could ultimately share. So the public expectation needs to be really clear as to what are we actually going to gain out of that, because we have to make sure that that information that's compelled does not cross over into the other side of the investigation. If it does, that taints the criminal investigation, and then it opens up all the other arguments that we've already talked about. So one of the things that I think, and I think the Chief probably hit on pretty clearly, is we have worked really hard over the last several years to get as much information out in as much a timely way so that we can provide the community with the information that we have. I think the Bureau has come a long way in sharing information that we used to hold very close.
Well, and I think later I may even ask our consultant, the consultants, to come back and just help me better understand, in light of recommendation 41, how is the world different if we eliminate and follow their guidance? Because I still think I'm missing something.
Recommendation 31, you mean the
Recommendation 31.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure I understand it, and more importantly, that the public understands how this changes the way we do investigations.
Well, back to your sort of facial question, I may be guilty of oversimplifying it, but I believe I understand this correctly. George can improve that maybe. As an employer, we can compel a statement, but it contaminates the criminal justice investigation. So that's the choice. I mean, as it's currently configured, right?
That's the gist.
May I ask some questions?
To your yes or no question,
topic?
We can compel testimony, but then what happens? That it's no longer useful in a criminal investigation.
May I have a turn?
Please.
Thank you. What level of your staff are members of the Commanding Officers Association?
That would be all of our lieutenants.
Lieutenants and on up, or just the lieutenants?
Just lieutenants.
And are the lieutenants ever present at incidents like this?
Typically lieutenants are not generally involved in deadly force incidents, though they have been. Lieutenants are in charge of each of the shifts at the precinct. So there are uniformed lieutenants at the precincts who also are in uniform out on patrol at times.
So there might be incidents where a lieutenant would be called to the scene if there's a standoff, for example, and would the lieutenant go to the site or would the...
Oh, yeah. Supervisors and command will respond to major incidents. I thought you were looking at it as with the removal of that rule that impacts the lieutenants if they were involved in use of deadly force.
So if they're called to a scene and then subsequently there's a use of deadly force, how come the lieutenants could be forced to provide a report but nobody else would?
Because in the collective bargaining agreement.
But why would that not jeopardize all of their Fifth Amendment everything else?
All we have done, again, like George, we've removed that language. That doesn't mean, we're going to have to be very careful and in consultation with the district attorney on this particular case, because at the end of the day, what we have to decide is what is more important, an immediate information that we can only use for employment purposes, or a criminal investigation that if the officer has done wrong, the district attorney has the ability to charge that officer. So again, kind of like the commissioner was talking about, we've got that language removed, but it's what does that really mean, and what are we going to do when you look at the particular cases?
And how many times has a Portland police officer been the subject of a criminal investigation or by the district attorney?
They investigate every one of our shootings.
And have they ever?
Yeah, the most recent one was Officer Dane Reister.
And did he went to trial and?
No.
The point, it's not whether it results in a conviction, it's at what point does your Fifth Amendment right attach? And your Fifth Amendment right attaches when you are potentially a suspect, or you're reviewing your conduct, and we don't assert our Fifth Amendment rights.
Could I please continue to have a turn?
Well, I'm just clarifying something, because you raised an interesting point.
I was in the middle of a line of thought. So if it doesn't results in a trial and conviction, we don't usually legislate into this body to the lowest, to stop the absolute worst. We try to set some standards. It seems like there's a greater public good in having a system where most of the time we assume that the officer hasn't done the wrong thing and that we get that information in an expedient manner. Do all the other jurisdictions in Oregon have the 48-hour rule?
I'm not sure what the other organizations are doing.
Do we know what they have in Beaverton and in Gresham?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I think that's germane to this discussion. If it's okay in Beaverton and not okay in Portland, then that's something that we should look into. What legal basis do they have that? And I don't know whether they are either.
And the discussion you were starting to have, I think, is really right at the core of what we need to talk through. Because you're right, we at this point, because they're the district attorney's investigations, but we are prioritizing or preserving the ability that should the district attorney decide that they need to do a criminal prosecution, that could successfully happen, when the reality is the vast, vast, vast majority of these cases are not that. So discussing a system where we are prioritizing the internal employment process is a healthy conversation. But then the big caveat is, the district attorney's ability to potentially prosecute. But that is exactly the conversation that this brings us to.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your willingness to have that. And it actually, nationwide, it doesn't seem like there are that many prosecutions, and then victims and their families turn to the civil process to try to get some justice. So I think we should bear that in mind. For other incidents and arrests that officers are involved in, they get called to a domestic violence situation where somebody has assaulted somebody else, and they make an arrest. Are they required to document that and turn in a police report by the end of their shift?
Yes.
So what's the exception on providing documentation to what happened with the use of deadly force?
Because, again, then this comes back to that concept that we've been instructed from the district attorney and the city attorney on that transactional immunity, that if we are compelling you to write this report, essentially make a statement that because of the structure we use in an officer-involved shootings, it is a criminal investigation where the officer is not a suspect of something, but because he is being interviewed and reviewed in a criminal process, that's where he has the ability to have the protection of the Fifth Amendment.
I was a nurse, as you know, and the rule in nursing is if it's not documented, it wasn't done, and you're required to write notes on what you did at the end of every shift. And if you've done something according to hospital policy, even if it results in a bad outcome, you have that immunity that you're not going to get prosecuted criminally because of the bad outcome. You followed the hospital policy. You may get sued for something else, but you followed the policy. So it seems to me that we could come up with a system of required reporting that would tend to help make better decisions, given that we know that it doesn't very often result in a criminal case being sent to the grand jury and then sent to trial.
I think you're exactly right on, and that's the conversation. Is the community, is the district attorney, are all of you willing to look at a system that the vast majority of the time the need is not to protect the ability of a criminal prosecution, it is that immediate internal investigation. And that's core to this conversation.
And so for any other crime, we want to know what's been going on around. I mean, there may be other people involved beyond the person who was the subject of deadly force and the police officers involved. There may be others that maybe it's part of a gang violence situation that we would want some accurate documentation of what all was going on there so we can go after the others who are involved in whatever mayhem may have been happening. I mean, how would that, supposing there's a, you know, shootout at the OK Corral or whatever, and there's just major stuff going backwards and forwards, would none of those officers be required to write reports until later?
We require all witness officers to, we immediately interview them that night at these scenes. So our challenge would be when you don't have a witness officer. In many of our incidents, there's other officers there that are not involved members in the use of deadly force. So we interview them right away that night to start figuring out what happened.
How many of the situations that are reported here are things that happened very quickly versus, like in an instant like the Mr. Hatch, and versus called to a scene, could back off, spend some time negotiating, and then move in? Do you have a sense of?
Well, the two that have occurred.
Yeah, we have some of both in here.
While I've been here, which were the two in the last two, February of 2013 and March of 2013, both happened very quickly.
Yes.
Prior to that, some of each, right?
Because possibly what we could do while we continue to work through this is to add to the protocol that an officer is assigned to the scene to be the observer and documenter in a situation that's developing, not part of the team that's managing the situation, kind of like the sergeant's supposed to be. They're still part of it because they're managing it, but is there somebody else who could just give us just the facts, you know, not...
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep going, but I've got a thought of it.
Close to done at this point.
So it works out that way in practice, and that is if it is a major incident that is potentially going to involve deadly force. The Bureau is dispatching enough officers to that scene that there have been some officer-involved shootings since that aren't covered in this report where I've been present shortly after the incident. And the number of people on scene is significant if it goes on more than a few minutes because backup officers are arriving.
And would all those officers be counted as part of the response and therefore not allowed to be asked for?
No, they're all potential witness officers.
If they are. What we call an involved member is somebody who either uses deadly force or if it's a supervisor directing the use of deadly force. Anybody else who is there, we look at them, are they a witness member? Did they see, hear, you know, observe anything? And so we interview and talk to them that night at the scene.
And they're required to document what?
Yeah, like the detectives interview them and write a detailed report.
Thank you. I was very impressed with your response, not only because it's well-written and very complete. I've been in multiple of these hearings where the response of previous chiefs has not been agree, yes, we'll do that, yes, we're... And I appreciated the comment, well, if it's all, we're already doing that and it's going on a shelf... That's clearly not the intent here. The only one, then, that you disagreed with was the use of the canine in the case of Mr. Hatch.
Yes.
And I wanted to give you the opportunity to tell me why the ballistic shield wasn't used in that case.
Yeah, this was the only recommendation that we agreed, and you heard Mr. Giannacco on the front end talk about, and you heard me mention robust discussions. I really appreciate